You are tuned into the Dr. Tina Show with Dr. Tina Moore. For more, visit drtina.com. On this episode of the Dr. Tina Show, I'm sitting down with fellow naturopathic physician, Dr. Greg Kelly. Dr. Kelly is the Vice President of Product Development at Neurohacker Collective and Qualia, and we are diving into the undead world of zombie cells. Seriously, that's a real phrase going around these days in reference to senescent cells. Cellular senescence is a process by which a cell ages and permanently stops dividing, but does not die. Over time, large numbers of these old zombie cells can build up throughout our bodies. And get this, they can also easily turn healthy cells into more zombie cells. The good news is that there's much to be done about this process, and Dr. Kelly breaks it all down for us on today's show.
Qualia Senolytic is definitely going to be part of my monthly routine going forward. If you also want to resist aging at the cellular level, try Qualia Senolytic. Go to neurohacker.com/Dr. Tina for up to $100 off and use Dr. Tina at checkout for an additional 15% off. That's neurohacker.com/DRTYNA for an extra 15% off your purchase. And thanks to Neurohacker for sponsoring today's episode.
So let's jump in. Dr. Greg Kelly, thank you so much for coming on the Dr. Tina Show. I am excited to have you here today. You are the Vice President of Product Development for Qualia, and I have been secretly lurking on your supplements, to be honest with you. And I'm very excited to talk with you today about senescent cells. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here today. It's exciting to get to talk with you. And, you know, as we were mentioning before, you know, we're both naturopathic doctors, but hadn't crossed paths. So it's exciting to get to, you know, meet you, share a bit about senescent cells and other things to do with healthy aging with your listeners.
Yeah, yeah. So I have been lurking your Instagram, the Neurohacker Instagram, and really love it because my background's in regenerative medicine and I'm a chiropractor too. And I love all things neurology, neurophysiology. And I actually didn't even realize that I've been listening to the podcast that you guys have, and I've been really getting into the NAD part of it. And then my podcast producer asked me if I wanted to have you on the show, and I was like, heck yes, let's do this. So, and I've been seeing this senescent conversation all over social media, and I understand it from a regenerative medicine standpoint, but really excited to hear your take on all the things and excited to pick your brain today. So this will be fun. So we're both naturopathic physicians, so we can just geek out on that too, and that'll be great. First question, what are senescent cells for the audience? I hear them described as zombie cells. That's probably what the folks listening have heard. How would you describe them?
So senescent cells, just the first frame I would say is think of there being senescent cells as a category of things. And you can almost parse it into transient ones that are beneficial that would come in after, you know, like a, you know, a intense exercise session, or when we need to, you know, heal tissue, that are going to come in, they'll be prominent for a couple of days, and then they'll die off or be scavenged by the immune system. So the ones that are more thought of as zombie cells, think of those as lingering senescent cells. They're the ones that, for whatever reason, never went away. And so when you think of senescent cells, often that distinction gets missed. And in a like a rejuvenative medicine context, the transient ones play an important role. You know, so we're really not focused on those in an aging zombie sense. It's and the reason the zombie name is because these lingering ones have figured out a way to stay alive, to what would be called resist apoptosis. So the natural process that a stress cell should go through, or even a healthy cell after it's kind of lived its life cycle, is what's called apoptosis, which is from a Greek word that literally means something like falling off, in the sense of a root falling off a tree or a leaf falling off a branch. And so the a characteristic of the lingering senescent cells is they resist apoptosis, so they stay in the body. And then another big characteristic is that they secrete these compounds into the microenvironment around them called SASP factors, but it's senescence-associated secretory phenotype. And phenotype for listeners just means like a characteristic, right? Like the behavior of these cells. So those SASP factors they secrete can take otherwise healthy cells and turn them into senescent cells. So it's that combination, right, of resisting apoptosis and fundamentally making otherwise healthy cells into new, you know, stress, dysfunctional senescent cells that give rise to that zombie metaphor.
Oh, I didn't know they could do that. So they basically, that's probably, yeah, where the zombie thing comes in. They touch them and turn them. That's not good. Wow. So these senescent cells that are lingering, they're using resources, right? They're using the bodily resources.
Yeah. So the analogy I came up with, in part, so zombie, that analogy was out there way before Qualia decided to do something in the senescent cell area. But our VP of marketing is a big gardener, so she's really avid. And I had to explain it to her, right? So it's like, okay, well, imagine in your garden, you have, you know, one of your plants and a leaf is yellow. Like, think of that as being a senescent cell. It should just fall off the plant, right? It turned yellow. It's not, you know, functioning well. It should go away. But imagine it doesn't. Now, if that sticks on the plant, then it's going to attract pests. It's going to use resources that would be better served for, you know, otherwise green leaves. By attracting pests, it's probably going to make nearby leaves less healthy. They'll maybe yellow as well. And that's kind of what senescent cells are equivalent. They're the yellowing leaf equivalent within our tissues and organs that didn't fall off the plant. And then because of these SAS factors, they're slowly turning more and more cells, the equivalent of being yellow leaves. And so, you know, the idea of senolytics, which we will get in later, is, you know, we need someone periodically to play gardener and come in and prune these away.
That totally makes sense. And so true. I actually just, I hacked up a houseplant the other day and my husband looked at it and he was like, what have you done? And I was like, just wait. It'll be great. And it is. It's coming back. It's so happy. But it was definitely having some resources being sucked from it, from same thing, just sort of like dead and drying and decaying branches that I hadn't been pruning correctly or you know, timely enough, I should say. So what starts this process in the body? Is this something that's happening all the time? Does it kick up in a specific age group or period of life?
So senescent cells as a category, I guess like history lesson is the Hayflick limit, which you would know, was discovered in 1961. And before that, it was thought that if you had cells in a cell culture growing in a lab, they would essentially live forever. And what they discovered in that research was that human cells would on average have 50 replications before they wouldn't replace themselves anymore. So they had a limit of the number of times they could divide. And that idea became what eventually the term senescence or cellular senescence became applied to that, like these cells that no longer could make copies of themselves. So that was the original use of cellular senescence. And that would be what I would refer to as replicative senescence, meaning if a cell is replicated itself enough times, telomeres get shorter, the cell doesn't want to risk copying damaged DNA, so it's just frozen. It won't make new copies. So that idea of replicative senescence way back was thought that's the only reason cells become senescent. But what was discovered over time is what would be thought of as premature stress-induced senescence. So there's all kinds of things you could do to stress out that culture of cells. So, you know, poor nutrients, ionizing radiation, all kinds of things, really many of the same things that stress our whole body can cause cells to become senescent way in advance of that replicative senescence. So what I think is the main thing with aging is more that stress-induced. I don't think, in a practical sense, we don't really ever run out of the ability to make new cells for them to divide into new offspring. But I do think there's lots of things that cause our cells to prematurely become aged because of stress. And then categories of things, you know, so mitochondrial dysfunction, which I'm sure your listeners mm-hmm. are familiar, would be another thing that was well known to cause cells to become senescent well in advance. So, you know, anything that causes our mitochondria to perform poorly. But just in a big picture sense, I would say think in terms of stress. Things that are going to cause stress at a whole body level are probably causing it on a cellular level. And if the stress is too much or prolonged, then the software program that cells execute, or, you know, one of them, is becoming senescent. And then the last reason is that zombification I mentioned, right? Them secreting these SASP factors. So that's often called secondary senescence or bystander effect. But the general idea is it's senescent cells creating new senescent cells. And part of the reason it's thought that it really explodes with aging is because that's adding in to it, right? Almost like that snowball rolling downhill. 2 is becoming 4, 4 is becoming 8, 8 is becoming 16, right? So you're just having kind of an exponential growth with senescent cells creating new senescent cells from their nearby neighbors.
Do you have you found in the research that this kicks up or starts to ramp up around middle age or maybe with a menopausal situation with women or andropause with men?
So the to look at senescent cells, you have to do a biopsy, and then the researchers have to know what they're looking for. Even a researcher, there's not one single marker that they would look at and say, oh, this is there, so that means it's a senescent cell, or it's not there, you know, so it's not healthy and it's a senescent cell. So they really would look at a combination of things. And so because of that challenge, there's just not as much research in humans saying, oh, at this age or in this health state, this is what we see. But what has been done is more, there is almost a decade by decade increase in multiple tissues, but not evenly. So, you know, for like at one point, it was thought that the three types of cells most prone to become senescent were fibroblasts. So those are our connective tissue cells, right? So joints, skin, between tissues and organs. Endothelial cells, so, you know, lining our vessels, and then immune cells. And it was thought, oh, it's probably not a big deal. Most of the other cells, likely it's not too big of an issue. Since then, it's been found that really all cell types can become senescent. And I guess just getting, stepping back maybe, the general thing you'd see if you Googled it is, you know, the question was, how long do cells live in the body? You'd see an average of 7 years. But that 7 years is very misleading. So you have neurons last a lifetime. They've even transplanted neurons from one animal to another. They live in that second animal their lifetime as well. So,
wow.
So neurons aren't meant to be replaced. So it was cells that don't create daughter cells originally were thought, well, they can't become senescent because senescence is about, you know, not making, you know, copies that would be in error. But then other cells, like in our heart tissue, those cells on average live 4 decades, muscles about 15 years, liver cells 1 to 3 years, right? So it just varies on the tissue and the capabilities for those tissues to replace cells. So it used to be thought that these really long-lived cells wouldn't become senescent, really what would be the point. We don't make many copies of them in our lifetime. But senescence is clearly doing something different than just, you know, preventing errors, right? It's more of a stress response. So the big picture is that any tissue can have senescent cells. And what science has found, and this is mostly in animals, is that load, and I tend to think of the idea of a threshold effect, mm-hmm. same way I would think of pollens with allergies, right? That it's, you know, they're there at a low level, probably in a 25-year-old, you know, below any threshold that they're causing, you know, things that would show up as symptoms or dysfunction in their tissues or organs. But at some point in the aging process, they pass whatever that threshold is, where now they're just creating a big challenge for that system or that organ or tissue to perform healthy. And again, I like that, you know, visualization of a yellow leaf, like 1 or 2 yellowing leaves, your plant's still probably gonna, you know, be doing pretty well. You know, it'd be better to prune them off. But, you know, if all of a sudden 5% or 8% starts to become yellowing leaves, that plant's going to start to really struggle. And if we don't do things to, you know, improve its health, then, you know, that plant has kind of a one-way short trip to, you know, probably not being in our garden or home very long. And I think a senescent cell is the same, that, you know, we can not with certainty say, like, Dr. Greg or Dr. Tina has X amount in this tissue or this tissue. We just know that, you know, me now compared to me 10 years ago, I would be expected to have more. And that some tissues would have disproportionately more than others, if that makes sense.
Totally makes sense. Yeah, I get that. Well, my, like I said, my background was in regenerative musculoskeletal medicine, and patient after patient would come in, and most of them were middle age, and they would say, you know, I was great. I was fine. I was active. I was healthy. And then one day the wheels started falling off the car. So when you said fibroblasts, I was like, oh, that totally makes sense. I mean, that's what you make your collagen out of. So like all of your soft tissues are fibroblasts are the source. And so that makes a lot of sense to me. And then for me personally, I was aging really, really well. And then it was not just physical stress or pathologic stress. It was like the stress of the world during the past few years really came to a peak. And I noticed, I mean, I felt like I was aging fast forward in front of me in the mirror. You know, it's just, I couldn't believe how quickly it was happening, because I was like, damn, just that elevated cortisol. And then it sends your metabolism sideways. And once your metabolic health starts to degrade, there's, you know, and the insulin resistance starts to creep in. Even, and I've talked about this on the show at length, and I don't know if you've seen this with folks, but or with patients, but even when all their labs look perfect, there is this cellular insulin resistance that starts to creep up on them. And it doesn't show up on lab work, but it really starts to show itself, like the waist circumference starts to come on and the skin starts to look aged and everything starts to sag. And, you know, maybe some pathological issues creep up or the autoimmune disease decides to rear its ugly head a bit more. And I've seen this with men and women. So this probably is a huge factor in that. I'm guessing there was just a kick up in that senescent situation. And
yeah. And I would say absolutely yes. In the studies in animals, senescent cells, In every tissue they've looked at, whether that's the brain, joints, skin, the gut microbiome, like the lining of the gut, that area, senescent cell accumulation is very strongly tied into poor performance with aging in those animals. And doing things to keep them more manageable reverses those challenges to a large extent. So, you know, and I think that idea of stress is important. And at a cellular level, you know, they're little living organisms as well, right? And like, you know, kind of an old-time naturopathic thing, like the health of, you know, us is relying on the health of our tissues. Their health is relying on the health of the cells in those tissues, right? And, you know, so when I think of, you know, what happens with stress on a cellular level, it's a range, it's kind of a menu of options they have depending on the degree of stress, how long it lasts, what their, you know, resistance or resilience is. And so I usually think their first response to stress is going to be to toughen themselves up, right? Make more antioxidant defenses, you know, upregulate glutathione. And if that's not enough, then they're probably going to take on some damage, right? Which is common, right? And then you have things like autophagy, that's a repair program, or, you know, other things that are cellular processes that are intended to repair damage, right? So we have those things. But if a cell takes so much damage that it's not repairable, that's now a senescent cell, or, you know, a cell that maybe it's even more damaged and it goes directly into necrosis, right? It just, you know, gets killed off right away. And so there's almost this menu of responses to stress that are all part of normal physiology. Cellular senescence is just the option when a cell has been so stressed out that it took on enough damage it can't be repaired. And what should happen, and what does happen in the transient ones, is that they then like would go through apoptosis. And for listeners, apoptosis, so a question we get once in a while is, oh, like how do we detox senescent cells once they go through whatever they go through? And apoptosis isn't like detox. It means it's really fragmenting. It's just breaking apart into little pieces. And then the immune system comes in and gobbles those pieces up and recycles and reuses them, right, to create new immune cells. And so the better image is, again, that gardening metaphor, right? A yellow leaf finally falling off the branch into the soil and being recycled for nutrition, new growth for that plant. And so that's really what should happen with senescent cells. But the lingering ones, they're just, you know, figured out a way not to go through that. And have also, I think of the immune system as the backup plan for stress cells. They've also figured out ways to both avoid the immune system. And we all know that the immune system struggles more and more as we get older, right, with what's called immunosenescence, right, immune system aging. And so it's less good at finding stress cells. So that's almost like a double whammy as well with aging.
That makes a lot of sense. So does autophagy get screwed up then when the cellular milieu becomes more senescent cells? Does that activity, like I know we talk about fasting and different ways to induce autophagy, but sometimes it just doesn't seem to be working as well in some folks.
Well, think of like before a cell is senescent, we want to do things to prevent it from becoming senescent. And autophagy helps do that, right? If we have autophagy doing its job, a cell won't become so damaged to be unrepairable. But once a cell has become senescent, it can still use the autophagy program to keep repairing itself to, help linger, right? So autophagy, right? Like, so autophagy, like most things, it's the context. And so that senescent cell is going to use the same programs and resources that healthy cells would use, but to resist apoptosis. Right? So we still want to do things to promote autophagy. Just autophagy on its own wouldn't be something that would help prune away senescent cells. It would maybe help us or slow the accumulation of new ones.
Got it. I got it. So do we want to promote apoptosis then? What's the goal? What do we do with these senescent cells, I guess is my question.
Yeah. So the original work on around 2010 was, I think, the landmark study. And what they did in that case was they genetically modified animals so that they wouldn't produce senescent cells and noticed that they didn't have many of the issues with aging that other animals had. So cool, but what do you really do with that information? And then in 2015, Mayo Clinic, Scripps Institute of Aging co-authored a paper, but the gist of it was they had this idea that, well, there's certain networks of proteins within cells that senescent cells are essentially manipulating to resist going through apoptosis. And those are generically called SCAP networks, and that's senescent cell anti-apoptotic pathways. But basically, just think of it as networks of proteins within cells that when those are more active, a cell will resist going through apoptosis. Okay. So the big insight they had is, well, let's take compounds that we know that do things to normalize those protein networks and put those in cell cultures with senescent cells and see if they cause the senescent cells to finally go through apoptosis. And what they found was at the time, two things, quercetin, which I'm sure many listeners know and use, and then a medication called dasatinib, which is an immunomodulator medication. And they, out of all the things that they tested, based it on this mechanistic understanding of trying to correct these protein networks in cells to finally get them to go through apoptosis, they're like, oh, these two things seem to work, and they work even better when we give them together. And so that original paper, that was the big aha that, oh, there are things we can do that will finally get these cells to, and the phrase I heard, recapitulate the journey to apoptosis, right? So, and that when those compounds were given together, these older animals behaved and looked like much younger versions of themselves. So the researchers at the time used the term senolytic for—
Got it.
Compounds that would be that category of thing. And in general, think of a senolytic as something that's correcting these protein networks so that these cells will finally go through this apoptosis process.
So we want them. So when I describe apoptosis to folks, I say that it's basically cell suicide. Like it's the cell's blowing itself up with little packets of hydrogen peroxide, right? Is that accurate? Is that a decent description?
Yeah, it's usually thought of as, like, there's a range of cell death. So necrosis is unplanned, right? Like you get bit by a spider and it kills some cells because of the venom, right? Mm-hmm. That was unplanned. They just die in a very unorganized way. Apoptosis is the opposite. It's a really programmed, like the cell will start to change in anticipation of going through this disintegration process, and it will be involved in causing its own disintegration by mechanisms like you describe. And there's even, you know, now an understanding that there's something between those two extremes that's, you know, somewhat necrosis-like, somewhat, you know, programmed like apoptosis. Yeah, and it's normal. Like when I was mentioning the how long different cells live in tissues, they're all largely dying through that this process of apoptosis. It's completely normal that cells would be born, live fruitful lives, and then eventually cue themselves up to be, you know, to, you know, disintegrate and be replaced by new cells from stem cells making new cells or other cells, you know, creating clones of themselves, right, to fill that space. And so apoptosis is only problematic if in two contexts, right? If apoptosis is too much, right, then, you know, we wouldn't have the cells to fill a tissue potentially, right? So that's, you know, unusual, but, you know, most things there's a Goldilocks rule.
Right.
And if apoptosis isn't happening to stress cells, then we start to have challenges, you know, like cancer cells as a category would be different than senescent cells, but they would be a type of stress cells that also are resisting going through that apoptosis, right? So, you know, it's why they can both fill space that should be in a tissue or organ with healthy cells, but also, you know, grow wildly even beyond that. So
I feel like you're reading my mind because you keep mentioning the thing I'm about to ask you about next. My brain's just going down the path. It's so fun. Okay, so next question. I was going to ask you about cancer. That you explained that well. So we don't want to attempt to turn a senescent cell back into an active cell. We want to get it out of there. Am I understanding this correctly?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any work that would suggest you could reprogram a senescent cell back to being healthy.
Okay.
It's just taken on too much damage at that point. So yeah, the goal at that point is just to prune it away.
Got it. Clear it out. Now, what about quiescent cells? How do they play into this picture?
Quiescent cells would be something kind of in between, right? It's a cell that's not making copies of itself, but could still potentially make copies. A senescent cell, the distinction is it's not making copies and it's thought that it can't make copies, right? That's why part of the reason that the senescence program was enacted so that it wouldn't make new copies of itself. But what it does instead is zombify other cells, right? So, you know, it grows not because of making new copies, but because of changing the behavior of other nearby cells.
Because in the research, and mostly what I found was in mice, the obese state will, you know, because your immune cells will live inside your adipocytes and wreak all kinds of inflammatory problems. And then those cells will go into that quiescent state. And they never really took those studies long out. So I couldn't tell what exactly came of those cells. But from what it looked like, turning those cells back on is that quiescent state? Am I understanding that those still maybe can come back from, you know, the middle ground, it's like they're out in the ether. They're not really doing anything, but can they come back, or how does that all work? And how does metabolic health and maybe even the obese state play into that?
Yeah. So my understanding of quiescent cells is more like a category, but senescent cells are a category as well. So all quiescent cells wouldn't have the same behavior, but in general, a quiescent cell is quiet, but it's capable eventually of being woken up if the circumstances merited it.
Got it.
It's kind of a different state.
Okay.
And then in terms of metabolic health, so I think, you know, many listeners, and I probably would have been this way back, would think of, fat cells or fat tissue, that's just all fat cells, or muscle tissue, that's all muscle tissue, or the brain, that's just all brain cells, neurons. But tissues always have a variety of different cells, right? So the brain has neurons, which are the workhorse, but then it has glial cells, so microglia and astrocytes and all these other structural or immune cells. Adipose tissue is the same. So you mentioned already the immune cells. But what you would see with senescent cells in adipose tissue is that they're going to cause a lot of the challenges we think of if you just use the term metabolic obesity. Right. So independent of the amount of body fat, all of the issues with insulin and blood sugar and lipids. Senescent cells in adipose tissue seem like they really drive that phenomenon.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. Thank you. Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out. I figured if you've got a lot of senescent cells hanging out, you're probably not going to have very metabolically active tissue in the first place. I mean, it's going to be difficult to impart change on those tissues if there's a large population of senescent cells chilling out in there.
Well, and that SASP factor that I mentioned earlier, or factors mm-hmm. that they secrete, that's basically a soup of cytokines and other things that is a really inflammatory soup, so to speak.
Okay. Oh, wow. This is fascinating. It's all coming together.
So it's really thought that that's, you know, in addition to taking up space, you know, starving healthy cells of resources, it's that, you know, that inflammatory soup that they're secreting into the microenvironment, that's thought to be the most problematic thing that senescent cells are doing.
And this makes complete sense, because when you're looking at a joint, like so let's say somebody's knee starts going south, it's most often, in my opinion, and what I've seen clinically, it starts almost as like a diabetes of the joint. It's a, you know, there's a metabolic syndrome happening in the joint and in the joint region, and the leptin's in there, insulin's in there, estrogens are in there. I mean, there's receptors for all of these inside the joint. And it's like, once it starts, that's the hot mess. So it's usually a mechanical factor. It's been brewing, and then they go and take a step off a curb wrong, or something happens, you know, where they have like some kind of mechanical insult, traumatic injury. They think that's what started it. And I'm like, no, your overall metabolic health got it going. But then I always explain it too as that soup. You've got this inflammatory soup that joint is swimming in now, and it begets more problems. It's really interesting to think of it this way. It's probably the senescent cells that it probably started that cascade a bit. Can that cascade be kicked off like through those SASP factors?
Yeah. Well, so yes, but there's a couple things I think that are worth mentioning. One, and this study or these studies were done mostly looking at muscle tissue. But if you took a, you know, like the equivalent of a 20-year-old mouse and the equivalent of a 60-year-old mouse and intensely exercised both, they would both create senescent cells. Mm-hmm. But the young mouse, they would be that transient variety. They would, you know, come in, help draw the immune system in to create healing through those, you know, some other factors that it secrete. And then they'd be gone. They'd fall off. Be gobbled up by the immune system if there were stragglers. But the way I've read it described in older animals, it's like there's an explosion of senescent cells. So the oligodendron just makes way, way more. And then a week, 2 weeks, a month later, they're still there. They didn't go away. And to put that in the context of joints, one of the cool studies that was done is they basically injected senescent cells into the joint matrix of animals. And what they found is that caused almost arthritis, you know, within days, yep. Right? That, I mean, part of it, I saw some images from one of those studies, and it was like the senescent cells created this layer over the stem cell layer that prevented stem cells from doing their job to regenerate the tissue.
That's fascinating. That makes so much sense.
Yeah, so for listeners, the key thing, as we get older, we're likely, for the same stress, to create much more senescent cells, and the lingering variety instead of the transient one, which makes, you know, the same stress or trauma that, you know, our younger version of ourselves might have been able to bounce back quickly from, a lot more challenging for us because of the senescent cell load that we're now dealing with.
This brings it all together for me. You don't even understand. I've been seeing this happen, and I didn't know exactly what was happening. I knew that cytokines beget more cytokines. I mean, once you start that hot mess of inflammation in a joint or in a region, it's going to potentiate and propagate itself. And we see this with disc injuries, you know, intervertebral disc injuries, and we see it with joint pain and definitely with muscle tissue. And one of the hallmarks, just for the listeners, and I've said this before on different episodes, but one of the hallmarks of going into that metabolic dysfunctional state is you start to have this inflammatory induced sarcopenia. It's like this inflammaging. So these senescent cells must play a huge role in that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so in animal studies, sometimes they'll use the term anabolic resistance, but it's a similar state, right? And anabolic resistance, fundamentally think of insulin resistance, right? Except instead of insulin, it's the anabolic signals that muscles aren't responding well to, right? So that would be, you know, exercise or more protein in the diet. And what they found in a number of animal studies now is that anabolic resistance is strongly caused by the accumulation of senescent cells, and doing things like senolytics to prune them away all of a sudden resensitizes those older muscle tissues to anabolic signals.
That's amazing. Yeah, this totally adds up. This is super cool. Yes, I'm excited. I was so excited to pick your brain on all this.
Oh,
I have so many questions.
I've got another area that I think is cool, and I've seen a handful of studies, but a few recently, and it's with organ transplantation, which again, they've done these in animals. And what would normally happen with organ transplants is you're going to just get what's available that matches your blood type, your need. But in animals, if they transplant organs that were from old animals into young animals, they basically cause inflammation, right? They like that young animal now has, at least temporarily, a whole bunch of old person issues that crop up, because with those old organs, they also transplanted a bunch of senescent cells that were in those organs that are now, you know, causing not only local issues, but, you know, some of these inflammatory things can get into systemic circulation and start to cause issues. So what has been proposed, and I think it's an interesting area that we'll have more research, is doing senolytic compounds to clear them out of organs before you would transplant an older organ into a younger, you know, human or animal.
That is fascinating. It's funny, you literally were one step ahead of me. I was just going to ask you, what about these animal studies where they're taking young blood and putting it from a young animal and putting it into an older animal, and these animals are having age reversal? Is that something to do with this too?
It probably is. It may be other things as well. There's, you know, other things in the blood that wouldn't only be from senescent cells, but
sure. For
sure, like that, what I think of as the young blood. I mean, I think the original study on that where they put the two animals together and shared circulation goes back to the 40s. You know, now we have people like, you know, the Brian Johnson, you know, giving his son to,
yes,
you know, and then Brian giving his blood to his dad, right? So, in animals, there's definitely, it's very rejuvenating, right, to take in younger blood. But, you know, I guess the converse would be, you know, whether it's blood or organs, if we're taking in an older version of those from an external source, there's maybe some toll that's going to take on us as well.
Well, I firmly believe that our microbiomes are extremely contagious, and you are only as young as the people you surround yourself with, or the level of health of the people you surround yourself with. I firmly believe that. And I've always been very sensitive to the health of others. It impacts me and I feel it. It's one of the reasons I closed my practice down. I was tired of being around sick people that were in pain all day. Like it just wasn't good for my health anymore. And I have often wondered if this was something to do with it too. I was just, for me, I was more thinking in terms of stem cells, but I'm wondering, and I don't know if there's any data on this, but I'm betting we're going to find down the line that it, cause I mean, we have some, you know, probably some weak studies in humans, or at least where they looked at, you know, if you hang out with young people, you're going to think younger, you're going to act younger, you know? And I really wonder if some of these cells aren't jumping ship and being shared, maybe even in intimate relationships. I don't know. Am I way off base, or is there anything to this?
No, I would think there's something to it. I mean, if you just think evolutionarily, you know, in a village type of lifestyle, right, which humans would have been in, you know, older humans would have interacted with middle-aged humans, with young humans, you know, very different than maybe like my mom currently is in assisted living. My dad passed away a long time ago. They're only really interacting with, you know, other old people and maybe the staff and, you know, occasionally visitors. But, you know, if you compare that, they're almost starved for company with, you know, babies and younger organisms that would have, in a sense, a young microbiome, right? Not only in their gut, but on their skin and other places.
And I think that's going to impact their cells, whether they are senescent or not. Well, do we have interplay between the microbiome and senescent cells?
So The hallmarks of aging is one of the, it's kind of a model for aging, and there's 12 hallmarks. And just think of those as shared things from whether it's, you know, mice, humans, monkeys, flies that happen at a cellular level. And cellular senescence is one of those 12. But in January 2023, dysbiosis was added to the list. There was 9 going into that year. And so I think what I've seen, there was just a new study on CAR T, immunotherapy. And the study, you know, they used that to impact immune cells in the gut, and it rejuvenated the gut, both the microbiome and barrier function and other things. So without question, senescent cells in the gut area, you know, almost cause dysfunction in that, just as like they would in our joint tissues or somewhere else. And doing things to manage them makes that system perform better. But since that system, whether it's the gut-brain axis or the gut-joint axis or the gut-muscle axis or the gut-skin, it impacts everything, right? So, you know, if we do things to keep that system performing at a younger level, I think it just makes it so much easier for the rest of our body to perform well.
For sure. Yeah, this is fascinating. What are some of the other big hallmarks of aging?
Oh, yeah. So the original 9, you know, cellular senescence was one. Mitochondrial dysfunction was another. Telomere attrition, which I mentioned earlier, was thought originally to be the main cause of senescent cells. Now I think of that as, you know, not particularly a fairly unimportant one in an aging context. Stem cell exhaustion is another. They would call it altered proteostasis, but a lot of proteins have to move through cell membranes, whether it's, you know, cell membranes, mitochondrial membranes, and they get folded and unfolded in that journey. And proteostasis is thought of as protein quality control, but basically making sure that our proteins stay, you know, in the correct conformation, right? So that's, you know, another. One's intracellular signaling, one's nutrient sensing. So the intercellular signaling, that's your insulin and, you know, all the, you know, things related to that. Nutrient sensing is how cells, you know, respond to things in the environment. So those are, you know, like your protein sensing mTOR pathway. But a lot of the senolytic polyphenols work on nutrient sensing pathways.
This is super interesting. Polyphenols also play in the gut to induce GLP-1 secretion. Am I right?
Yeah, certain ones, you know, but not only those, like berberine, which isn't a polyphenol, but something found in, you know, many plants that naturopaths would use, like, you know, your Oregon grape and coptis from the Chinese tradition as examples, or hydrastis, like golden seal. Berberine's an alkaloid. And the clue for listeners, when you see the I-N-E ending, think probably alkaloid. When you see an I-N like quercetin or fisetin, think polyphenol. It won't always be right, but it, more often than not, that simple heuristic will get you in the right place. But yeah, berberine is something that promotes GLP-1 secretion, but some polyphenols, like polyphenols in grape, the grape seed particularly, do as well. So yeah, there's a range of plant compounds. They just don't do it as strongly, you know, as, well, anywhere near categorically as strongly as the medications that target that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the medications mimic it for the most part. I don't even know why they call them agonists, because they look just like, I mean, they basically are GLP-1. I think of GLP-1 agonist medications as hormone replacement. I mean, because GLP-1's a hormone at the end of the day, it's a signaling hormone. And those drugs are acting as that hormone. Whereas all of these other compounds that are like nature's Ozempic that get sold as that, it's great if the gut's in good health, if the L cells are working, that's awesome to stimulate, but some people's guts are pooped out and they are in a bad state, and you can take all the berberine in the world and you ain't getting no GLP-1 out of those L cells. So, or they're aged, or, you know, they've lost the mucin lining, or yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, but anyway, I digress. So, oh, this is super fascinating. So that takes us to senolytics, and you've described a bit how they work. How do you use them? How would we as normal people, like, now that I'm super interested in this, because I want to get rid of my senescent cells, tell me more.
Yeah, so the I mentioned the original work that Mayo did where they identified quercetin. And what they found at that time is that quercetin helped remove senescent cells in some tissues, but not others. And the medication, dasatinib, almost was the mirror image. It worked in some tissues that quercetin didn't and wasn't active in ones where quercetin was. And so right from the get-go, you know, there was this recognition that something can be senolytic, but that doesn't mean that it can remove all types of senescent cells or senescent cells in all categories. And so maybe it's important to stack things together. The other recognition from that early research was that there's these networks of proteins that senescent cells are using to resist apoptosis, and that maybe doing things where we target different parts of those pathways would be additive for getting rid of them, right? So quercetin works more nutrient sensing pathway. Dasatinib works in a very different way, as an example. So what the next step was that other researchers started saying, oh, well, quercetin was senolytic in that research. I wonder if other polyphenols or other plant compounds would be as well. And the next one that was found, and it was about 2 years later, is something called piperlongamine, which is from long pepper. So like piperine, I'm sure some listeners would know of, right? It's a bioenhancer from black pepper. Piperlongamine is a similar alkaloid, but it's not found in the black pepper plant. It's not a bioenhancer. And it was found that that helped remove senescent cells in a really unique way that didn't at all duplicate what quercetin did, as an example. And then the next big study was, I think, published in 2018. And it was, again, that Mayo Scripps group of researchers decided, okay, well, quercetin has potential. Let's look at a bunch of other polyphenols and see what we see. And what they found is that of the 10 they tried, fisetin or fisetin, I've heard it said both ways, was the most powerful of the polyphenols that they tested. And it was active in more tissues than quercetin alone was. So really, I guess, long story short, over time, there's been a couple handfuls of compounds that are from plants that have been found to be potentially senolytic. Some are more active in some tissues, some are active in others. But the way that they're applied is usually thought of as hit and run dosing. And by that, it means you take a big amount of these potentially senolytic compounds for just a couple of days and then have a intermittent period where you didn't take senolytics again and then redo that protocol. And again, getting back to our pruning metaphor, most gardeners won't prune a plant every day. They'll prune it periodically as it needs it, or, you know, prune it maybe once every couple of weeks. If you pruned a plant every day, you'd, you know, potentially jeopardize its health. So The original thought was, okay, we want to make sure we err on the side of extreme caution. We don't want to, you know, be disruptive to healthy cells. So let's just give these big amounts of senolytic compounds for a couple of days, either every few weeks, once a month, and see what happens to the animals. And so that was baked in from the beginning, this idea of just doing large amounts and then not doing any senolytics and then have another cycle of large amounts. And part of the reason I think that's a really cool way to do it is it's something, I think it's called the Weber-Flexner law, which I never heard of in naturopathic school, but stumbled on in a psychology textbook at one point. But it was it goes back to the 1900s. But the gist of it was, for a long time, scientists have known that our senses don't respond to quantities of things, but the proportion of change. So the analogy I'll usually give is, imagine going into a completely dark closet, and now you light one candle. It's like, wow, like what a change. Mm-hmm. But now you go into that same closet, there's already 99 candles lit, you light one more, like big whoop, right? Like you might not even notice any change, right? So the quantity of one is not what matters. It's the proportional change in it. So all our senses, our eyes, our ears, are all based on that proportional change. It's why the decibel system is a logarithmic system, right? It's a proportional change. It's not a linear change. And my intuition is that receptors on cells, which would be the equivalent of their ears and eyes, are probably based on that same idea. Like, it's not the quantity of something that matters, it's the change in the quantity. And so the like what's super cool about doing a really high dose of these polyphenols like fisetin or quercetin over just a couple of days, you're creating a really big change to those receptors that are listening for things in the world around them. Where if you gave a lower amount of, say, this, those same two things every day, it's more like going into the closet that already has 99 candles and lighting one more. It's just not going to provoke the same response. So, you know, the key thing for listeners is when you're taking senolytic compounds like the Qualia Senolytic that we created at the Qualia brand, that the goal is to just take high amounts of these things for a couple of days, and then you're good for at least 2 weeks, if not longer. And then you just repeat over time to slowly prune them away.
I love this idea. And I've done this clinically with everything. I do this with hormones. I hit people with doses and then I back them off. And it's all about getting their receptors naked and sensitive so that it works. And just as an example, if you give somebody a low, you know, the big trend in the past couple of years has been to do, let's say, for instance, bioidentical hormone replacement, testosterone therapy for men, taking tiny little increments several times a week instead of taking that whole big dose once a week. And I've gotten much better results hitting people with even a, maybe a larger bolus every couple of weeks. And so, I mean, it makes sense to me cellularly to get the cell to, it's hormetic, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you're sort of inducing a hormetic response too, because you're causing the cells to activate. That's probably a little bit of a stressor on them in a good way. That makes them more sensitive, makes them more reactant and powerful, and then you back off. That, I don't know, does that play into this at all, or am I just putting two things together that are unrelated?
No, I think that like that makes sense to me, and I just like one of the things I thought of, like when would humans in our evolution have all of a sudden had crazy big increases in something like fisetin or quercetin?
Right,
and probably it would be famine, right? Because where those compounds accumulate in plants are all the things we either don't eat or we throw out, right? So fisetin's in strawberries, but you'd have to eat, kilograms of strawberries to get enough fisetin to have a senolytic effect. But like the Dutch famine winter, which occurred in World War II, during that, you know, the people there that couldn't get food were making soup out of leaves and tree bark and all these things we wouldn't eat that are going to proportionally have a lot higher amounts of things like fisetin. You know, quercetin's well known to be in onions, but it really concentrates in this outer layer that we throw out and the parts on the bottom with the frilly things that we throw out, right? That's like polyphenols tend to always accumulate where plants most interact with their stress, which is the outside world.
Yes.
So because of that, I think one of the things going way up in polyphenols in these brief spurts, it's causing cells to say, oh, my external environment, you know, changed evolutionarily. The only time it would have looked like this is when famine was coming. Let me get rid of everything that's not as essential. And all of a sudden, senescent cells now are almost unmasked to be finally eliminated. So I don't know if that's how it works, but that would be my intuition of at least a part of the reason it works.
That totally makes sense. Yeah, absolutely. Does cold therapy or exercise, are there any other things that play into removing senescent cells that we can do along with utilizing something like Qualia Senolytic?
My guess is that they would be things more likely to prevent their accumulation or to make their accumulation slower as opposed to getting rid of them once they're there. But in part, those studies just haven't been done because it's so hard to measure senescent cells, right? But for sure, things like calorie restriction for sure would slow down the accumulation. Exercise definitely slows down the accumulation of senescent cells in muscle tissue, whether it would, you know, be impacting maybe joints, maybe not, right? If they already have a stranglehold there, exercise may now be causing, you know, more stress on those and like a bloom of senescent cells there. So my guess would be that it would be tissue specific, but that most things we think of as stressful on us, maybe too much UV light, certain medications or therapies that are by their nature really stressful are probably causing some accumulation of senescent cells, and things that we think of more as hormetic that will, you know, make our cells more resilient to stress are probably making it so that fewer cells become unrepairable.
Once something starts, it's like once the wheels start falling off the car, it just potentiates more trouble and more problems. So this really, it's adding things up for me today.
One of the things that we do at Qualia is before we launch a product, we always want to do some kind of a, what we think of as a pilot study. So these are non-placebo controlled, but something where we're testing the whole recipe of things we've put together to see if it's improving performance. And since there's no really easy way to say, there's no marker you could look at in blood to track with senescent cells, none of the epigenetic clocks are useful for measuring senescent cells. So the area I eventually settled on is, well, we just look at joint function. We'll recruit people that are already challenged there. We'll use it's the WOMAC questionnaire. I'm sure you know of it.
Sure.
But it's just the most widely used thing for that. And we'll just, you know, do before and after. People do 3 cycles of Qualia senolytics. So again, a cycle is 2 days. In this particular study, we waited 12 days for the next cycle. So over about 5 weeks, there was 3 cycles of Qualia senolytic. And what we saw was in that initial study, about a 65% improvement in WOMAC. And for listeners, one of the things that I always see in studies is there's super responders, responders, and non-responders to things. So super responders means they got even a bigger response than that. Regular responders mean they got a response, but maybe not quite that good. And then non-responders, maybe it didn't change much for them. So we tend to see that in most studies. So, the average doesn't apply to everyone equally. Some people get more, some people get less is one thing to remember. So that study was compelling enough that we decided to make the product and start selling it. And then since then, we did a placebo-controlled study that we completed back in December of 2023. And in that, we saw that 65 to 70% decrease in total symptoms in the WOMAC. It was statistically significant compared to placebo. You tend to get a big placebo response in joint studies using WOMAC. And we also used another questionnaire called RAND-SF36, which is a general health questionnaire that has six buckets of things: energy, general health. One's called emotional function, but think of it as, are your emotions interfering with your ability to live, work, perform on a daily basis? Physical function, which is the equivalent, but, physical symptoms interfering. So again, what we saw in that was that energy increased about 65% over those 3 cycles. That trended to statistical significance, so it wasn't 0.05 for listeners that know what that means, but it was just slightly above that. And in part, it was a secondary outcome, so we didn't power the study for that. And then the other thing we saw both in our initial non-placebo SF36 study and in this placebo one is that area of how emotional well-being impacts our ability to live our daily lives improved dramatically more in the people doing the Qualia senolytic, which I think gets back to your gut microbiome. Like that, maybe that's a gut-brain axis thing, because many of these polyphenols are poorly absorbed, right? They are getting to our gut microbiome and having an impact there, which may be more of a feature than a bug. We tend to always hear like, oh, we want more bioavailability, but we probably do want some of these polyphenols to be getting to our gut microbiome and changing its behavior.
Sure. Well, if you're bombing them with a big dose for 2 days in a row, I would expect that they would change. I mean, I would expect that would be probably a hormetic assault on them too, which is good in a good way. So interesting. That's really interesting about the WOMAC scores. That's for the audience listening. That's a big deal. I did a lot of things to joints, and to get changes that were big it was not easy. So especially when folks had been long-standing in their arthritic state, particularly if they'd had it throughout their body. I mean, that's always a really bad sign. When we start to get synovitis and it's, multi-joint, it's like, oh, that's something systemic is going on, and I would always hang my hat on it being inflammatory, but it wasn't always that. So this is really, really interesting. Wow. Okay. Well, tell me more. So we do this protocol. You say it's 2 days in a row. And do you generally suggest people spread that out like a cycle each month, or how is it optimal? Does it depend on the person, depend on the condition?
So my default recommendation is just 2 days once a month. So that's how I do it personally. You know, and in that sense, I'm just thinking, okay, I want to be a good gardener for my body and make sure I'm pruning things away so that I'm keeping the tissue loads below the threshold where they're going to interfere with Dr. Greg being able to do what Dr. Greg wants to do. If someone had, you know, like already a challenge, like they were already struggling with joints, then I would more replicate the study, at least initially for maybe the first three cycles. So maybe do it like we did in that study, you know, 2 days, 12 days off, 2 days, 12 days off, 2 days. And at that point, if you feel like you've improved substantially, then maybe, you know, try out pruning once a month instead of, you know, twice a month, which would have been that. And that for someone younger, that's, you know, probably doesn't have as many that have accumulated, maybe they just want to do it, you know, once a quarter as, you know, like more of a preventative maintenance, you know, so, you know, think of in terms of like a fasting mimicking diet where you might do quarterly, you know, that type of thing. Maybe you do the quasi-senolytic, you know, once a quarter if you're, you know, say 30, you know, getting into the late 30s, because you'll be accumulating some at that point. But chances are, you know, unless some area of your health is really sticking out as suffering, chances are they're not impacting it strongly. But at any point when someone would have a lot of what you and I would think of as issues with that inflammation, you know, then you can almost bank senescent cells would be contributing. And in those circumstances, I would probably, you know, replicate what we did in our study where we do it a little bit more aggressively at the beginning. But the key thing is you always want to do it intermittently. So you want to always build in some downtime when you're not doing the senolytic.
I would guess as folks are getting older, or maybe those who are more metabolically busted, maybe dealing with some other chronic issues, like you said, be a little more aggressive up front and then pulse it. I love that idea of pulsing it. That makes, and cycling it. That fits right into the way I like to do things. So awesome. Well, anything else that I didn't ask you about? I feel like I had notes and I didn't even follow them. I was just sort of riffing off what you were saying. So I want to make sure to cover everything.
No, no. I think we hit a lot of high notes, and you know, so I can just share how I do it, right? So I take the quasi-senolytic product always the first weekend of every month. That's my easy, you know, and it's what I generally recommend to all, you know, my friends and family once I put them on it, is just to do it. And it's nice just having something that I just do 2 days a month and don't have to worry about it. And then, you know, the only other thing I would say is that, you know, just then pay attention to subtle things. Like, because what we've seen is that quasi-senolytic impacts people differently, right? If someone has joint issues, for sure the expectation is you'll notice something in that area. But if you don't, you know, like, you know, pay attention to your cognition, right? Like your mood, things like that. And then I've heard just some, you know, like, you know, these are all N of one, so anecdotal, right? No amount of anecdotal feedback is data, right? It's something, but it's not like a study. But I have heard from five different women now that had stopped their period and had it's restarted after doing cycles of quasi-senolytic, which almost seems like, huh, is it rejuvenating something in that system for those women? We don't know, right? It's, you know, it's something we didn't expect. But you know, so I guess the key lesson is just, you know, pay attention to, you know, lots of areas of your, you know, how you're performing if you do choose to take quasi-senolytic and see what improves.
Yeah, I love that. I haven't tried it yet. You guys sent me some to try and I haven't done it yet because I wanted to pick your brain first. I really wanted to understand what it was that I was doing and why, because it looked too simple, to be honest with you. And I sort of dismissed it. And then I was seeing it everywhere. And like I said, I've been lurking on your Instagram page and I was like, all right, I'm going to see if this is really what I think it is. So I had to get it from your mouth. Well, I love this, Dr. Greg. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your knowledge with us. I learned a ton and I'm really excited. You truly have put like two and two together for me. A lot of clinical knowledge that I had adding up to what was going on there with senescent cells. So thanks so much. Where can folks find you? And I want to make sure that I let them know that they can save on, I've got a coupon code for them. I'm going to put it in the show notes, but where can they find you and find more information from you?
Yeah, so it's our brand has always, or our company's always been Neurohacker Collective. You know, so on Instagram, you know, it's Neurohacker has been it. On X, it's, you know, I don't know if it's Neurohacker Official. But the products have always been Qualia with something like, so Qualia Senolytic. And that's caused a lot of confusion. So we're rebranding and Neurohacker will disappear into the background and Qualia will take prominence. So right now, neurohacker.com is the place to find us, but that is likely going to redirect to something with Qualia in the URL sometime in the summer of 2024. And then, you know, like you, we talked about this before, Instagram, we put a lot of content on Instagram. Our social media person does a fantastic job. So, you know, please check us out there. And then I inherited our X account because it wasn't being used. And so that's where you'll see more things that are of interest to me, is if you choose to follow us on X.
Fun. Yeah, that'll be great. Your Instagram is awesome. I learn a ton from it. I geek out on it. I always link back to the blog posts and the studies. And I had no idea. I was not putting two and two together until recently that it had any relationship to Qualia. So I'm glad you cleared that up. I'll make sure the correct link is in the show notes. And then they have the coupon code to save and try out the Qualia Senolytic. And I hope you will come back and talk to me about NAD, because I've been geeking out on your podcast about that as well. So you guys have some great products to check out.
Would love that. Thank you for having me.
Go to neurohacker.com/Dr. Tina for up to $100 off and use Dr. Tina at checkout for an additional 15% off. That's neurohacker.com/DRTYNA for an extra 15% off your purchase. And thanks to Neurohacker for sponsoring today's episode.
Thanks for listening to the Dr. Tina Show. Please be sure to follow me on Instagram at Dr. Tina, that's DRTYNA, and Dr. Tina 2.0, as well as visit my website at drtina.com. This is a Resonant Media production produced by Drake Peterson and mixed by Chris McCone. The theme song is by John the Gilt. As always, you can email the show at podcast@drtina.com. And if you like this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. See you next week. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It does not constitute the practices of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is intended not to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions.